You get dickheads in any society.
I never said that I thought it would be bad.
Are you high now?
Yeah.
Hello, Tom Tilley with you for Hack. One way to stop rhino poaching is quite violent.
If you see a poacher, you can shoot them.
Another idea, less violent, involves 3D printing fake rhino horns. Find out how that will work in just a moment.
Hack. We paid our rent.
You owe me $7,727. Yeah.
Is that American dollars or real dollars?
On Triple J with Tom Tilley.
Buying your own home has become a nightmare rather than a dream for lots of young Australians, which means we'll be renting longer, which means our rental rights are extremely important. As you're about to find out, they're often not good enough. New research from Choice shows that young people are the most likely to experience discrimination when looking for a rental, and that's because of our age. It also reveals 50% of tenants are worried about getting blacklisted, which means they're scared of asking for repairs, sometimes really important repairs. Is that your experience? Are you scared to rock the boat with the landlord? Have you found that they don't take you seriously because you're young? Is the rental system stacked in favour of landlords? Tell me how it is. Give me a call. 1300 055 36. 1300 055 36. Here's Shalala Medora with the state of play for renters.
It was just like disgust. How come it took so long for this to get fixed? How come, like, we didn't know at the start? How come we moved into this house?
That's 23-year-old law student Laura. She and her flatmates had been living in their place in Wollongong for 2 years when their backyard started flooding. It took 3 months of phone calls to the real estate agent before a plumber was sent out. What he found was revolting.
When the original plumbing had been done, it wasn't up to code or to standard, and a lot of the things in our bathroom weren't plumbed any further than just the ground under the house. And so it turned out that a lot of the flooding was just sewage that hadn't been put properly into the city's water system.
But Laura and her flatmates are still living there, because they're worried they won't be able to find another place to live if they move out.
Just getting letters in the mail is, like, heart-stopping. I'm constantly stressed that we're going to get kicked out, and I know that we would have a lot of trouble finding another place.
The thing is, Laura's story is gross, but it's not that unusual. A new survey by consumer group Choice has found that demand for a rental is so high that tenants feel like they don't have a lot of power.
Oh, we paid our rent.
We paid our rent.
You gave me a cheque.
We gave you that cheque.
Young people cop it worse than most.
We'd applied for maybe 10 or so units and, yeah, had a lot of trouble trying to get accepted for places. We'd been applying for about a month until we finally found somewhere.
19-year-old Tiana did all the right things when she and her friend went looking for a place to live in Melbourne.
So I had a reference from the previous real estate agent who said, like, we'd always kept the house in good condition and inspections always went well, and my boss as well gave me a written reference. So I had all these good references.
But her age was working against her, and the real estate agent told her as much.
Went up to her and approached her and asked her how the application was going, and she said that there was probably a slim chance we'd get it, as the owners were concerned of our age and thought we'd make a lot of noise and we'd throw parties and sort of trash the place.
The Choice survey said just over half of renters under 35 have experienced discrimination, and a quarter of them say it's because of their age.
It seems that you've got better rights if you buy a toaster and it doesn't work than if you rent a property spending hundreds of dollars every week and that property is not safe or secure.
That's Alan Kirkland from Choice. Roughly 2 out of 5 renters in Australia are under the age of 35. But they're the least likely to complain when issues arise in their properties, because they're worried they'll be blacklisted or labelled troublemakers.
This is about simple market factors. We've got a shortage of supply and we've got tenants, people looking for accommodation, who are really weak in the market. So that means that landlords and agents have got the power, tenants are disempowered, and that means they're desperate to get a property and desperate to hang on to one when they get one.
And it's not just places like Sydney, where competition for a place is fierce, that people are finding it tough, says Ned Kucha from the Tenants Union of New South Wales.
A small country town where there's only 2 real estate agents operating is just as competitive for the person who's been, branded a troublemaker who wants to rent a new home than the person who's lining up with 50 other, hopefuls that are at an inner city apartment in Sydney or Melbourne. It is across the board.
Tenancy laws are different depending on the state and territory in which you live, so it pays to know your rights. But part of the problem is a lack of security when it comes to rentals. One in five of us are on rolling month-to-month contracts, and landlords can chuck you out of a place at the end of a lease without offering a reason. Adrian Pizarski from National Shelter wants that to change.
The most pernicious aspect of all tenancy legislation around the country is that people can be evicted at the end of their lease for no reason whatsoever. If we can end one single aspect of our tenancy law, it would be that one, because that's what drives much of the insecurity that people face in their rental markets.
On Triple J.
Adrian Pizarski from the National Shelter ending that report. Lauren, you've had a shocking situation happen to a friend of yours. What happened?
Yeah, so back in 2015, I just moved into my first rental with a couple of friends, and we'd only been there for about a week when my housemate had tried to use the oven and it wouldn't turn off. So we'd emailed our agent asking for an electrician, to which she replied, "Have you checked the timer's off?" We had, and so we'd emailed back to with no response. After that, it was about 5 p.m. on a Friday, so this was the weekend, and we couldn't get in contact with the agency, even though we tried over the weekend. So our oven actually stayed on for 3 entire days.
Whoa, that is so dangerous.
Yeah.
What happened?
So on the Monday, my housemate had got in contact with her, and she told her to go outside and turn off the RCD switches. She did, and she got electrocuted. Blue sparks went everywhere, and she saw stars. At that point, an electrician was sent out, but they only removed...
At that point, an electrician was sent out. Isn't that messed up?
Yeah, so it took that. When the electrician came, they removed the dials from the oven, but because it was so old, they couldn't find replacements. And so we were told to turn on our oven with pliers for the rest of the year because our landlord... didn't want to pay for a new oven. And after all that, our agent was actually promoted even after we complained about her.
Wow. Did you take any further action?
No, we didn't, because we didn't want to, as I said in just the report there, we didn't want to be blacklisted and seen as bad tenants who were complaining about their landlord.
Wow. What a horror story.
Yeah, it is, definitely.
And have you learned any lessons from that?
Definitely know our rights. We weren't sure at the time whether we could have just called an electrician anyway over the weekend. So that would have helped at the time.
And then get them to pay for it later.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Yeah, that can be hard sometimes because you might not be able to pay up front, or there are other complications. So it's a tricky situation. Such a shocking story there, Lauren. And it goes to the heart of this research. Thanks so much for joining us.
No worries. Thanks, Tom.
I'd love to hear your stories. Do they match up with what's in that research? You're scared to call your agent for repairs, even really important ones, because you're worried you'll put them offside, maybe get blacklisted. Lots of people are. That's what we've just found out in this research from Choice, where they surveyed 1,000 tenants. Two people shaking their heads during that story are in the studio with me. Malcolm Gunning, who's a real estate agent. He's the president of the Real Estate Institute of Australia, works as an agent in Sydney. Malcolm, thank you for joining us.
It's a pleasure, Tom.
Our other guest fights for tenants. She stands up for their rights. She's a lawyer. Her name is Leah Hecht, and she's the acting principal solicitor at the Tenants Union of Victoria. Leah, what do you think of that story?
Thanks for having me, Tom. So exactly what Lauren expressed is what we experience at the Tenants Union. We get so many calls where people are asking for advice. How do they exercise their rights to get an oven fixed? Potentially there's an electricity issue, which is extremely dangerous. And many tenants, especially young people, explain that they don't want to exercise their rights because they're afraid of getting a notice to vacate for no reason, of getting a poor rental record. And even if they're aware of their rights, it is a reality that people have to face. How can exercising their rights impact on their housing and their security of tenure?
And it seems like they have good reason to be fearful of those consequences. The survey said 11%, so 1 in 10 of renters, copped a rent hike after requesting a repair. And 10%, again, 1 in 10, said that their landlord or agent became angry after they requested a repair. Malcolm, as a real estate agent, why does this happen?
Often to do with your landlord. It's a very difficult situation. The story that we just heard is absolutely not acceptable. It poses a risk. It's an insurance risk. If the property caught on fire, the landlord would have little recourse if the tenant reported that reported the oven couldn't be turned off. Look, it's a very difficult situation from an agent's point of view. Sometimes you've got a landlord who won't spend any money, and you are under instructions to your landlord to a certain extent, but a good property manager will probably squeeze their landlord and say, listen, these tenants have their rights, this needs to be fixed.
Sure, but, you know, no matter how much of a tight-ass a landlord is, surely there's standards to upkeep.
There is. And under the tenancy that you sign, it's prescribed what's got to be done. And unfortunately, being a property manager, probably the worst job, residential property manager, probably the worst job in real estate, is no one's ever happy half the time.
But yeah, I guess in that job, isn't it your duty to say to the landlord, this is not acceptable, you need to front up the cash, otherwise these people will be in danger or at least severe discomfort.
You're right, Tom. And that's exactly what
good agents do.
And so
Bad agents are lazy.
No, bad agents start to take the pressure on themselves and get very angry. Being a property manager, often you're handling conflict. If you don't, you can't get rid of that baggage, you can't work the centre line, you should get out of the business.
All right, lots of people are calling in. Sarah, you're a property manager, you're 21 years old. What's your perspective?
Well, just like the whole... Oh, hi, first of all. Sorry.
Hello.
First-time caller, long-time listener.
Excellent.
So as a young person myself, I can definitely sympathise for all those young people out there, because there definitely are those people that say, look, I'm young, I'm struggling to find a property, and I say, hey, no worries, I'm young too. I know where you're coming from. So me as an agent, I do not discriminate against young people trying to find a property. In regards to the whole maintenance thing, like something like that, like an oven that's not turning off, that's an emergency repair. I wouldn't even ask my landlord for that. I would just send an electrician to say, go fix it, because that's just dangerous. Like, someone can't live in a house with an oven that can't
Absolutely.
Turn off.
Now, Sarah, interesting to hear that you, as a 21-year-old property manager, feel like you don't discriminate based on age, but do you feel like some of your older colleagues in the industry do?
Yes, I definitely do. And that's when I turn around and go, I say, oh, hey, I'm only 21. Would you not let me rent a house?
Good to know you're in there sticking up for us, Sarah.
Yeah, no worries.
Thanks so much for the call.
You're welcome.
Malcolm, the survey says that this happens, that age discrimination affects young people more than it affects older people. Why does it happen?
I suppose track record. To a certain extent, if you're a young person coming in to lease a property and you haven't leased before, you don't have any credit reference as such or track record, it's difficult. And look, what I suggest to your listeners out there, if they're tenants, make sure you put together a dossier of who you are, what you are, your job, your references. It does put you on the front foot. Most property managers really looking for a tenant who can afford to pay the rent and respect the property.
Leah, how much this is a problem with people that you work with?
This is a very common problem. We often get calls from young people who've been turned down from housing because of their age, and there aren't many laws out there to protect people who feel that they've been discriminated against. The other difficulty is that a tenant might call a young person and feel that they've been turned down because they're young, and there are some laws that help to protect people from discrimination, and age is recognised as one of those factors protected by discrimination law. But in practical reality, how do you prove that age is the specific reason that you've been declined a property? And by the time that that goes through, you've lost a property and potentially you don't have housing, even though you are able to comply with your obligations under the law and you put together a good application and you can afford the rent.
Mm. On the text line, Alex from Rushcutters Bay says, I'm taking my agent to the tribunal at the moment. The house I was in didn't meet building regulations, so I moved out, and I'm going to fight them to the end. And, of course, that's what you can do. Leah, if people do want to take action, what's the best way to do it?
We recommend that if there's something going on in your tenancy, if it's maintenance problems, if you've got a problem with the landlord or the agent, to try and keep a record of that in writing, take photos of the property, and you can seek some legal advice from your local tenants union. So I work at the Tenants Union of Victoria, but there are specialist community legal centres throughout Australia in each state that can specifically provide specifically give advice on that area. And the other thing that we'd recommend is that you try and exercise your rights and report what's going on to the regulatory body in your state. So in Victoria, it's Consumer Affairs of Victoria, and let them know that if you feel like the landlord has given you a notice to vacate because you're exercising a right, let them know who that landlord is, who that agent is, and seek advice about what rights you might have to challenge that notice.
You're listening to Leah Heck giving some great advice on what to do if you get into a problem with your landlord. She is a solicitor at the Tenants Union of Victoria. Also in the studio is a real estate agent, Malcolm Gunning. We've got a minute left, guys. Solutions. Changing the laws around evictions, longer leases. What do you think, Leah?
From our point of view, I think, as was demonstrated in the Choice Survey and from our experience, security of tenure and people feeling like they have security of their tenancy and can't just be evicted with a notice to vacate for no reason is one of the very big things that is preventing people from exercising their rights.
Malcolm, would you like to see that change as well?
Look, long-term leases, I think something's got to be considered. Okay, that can be, as it is in commercial real estate, 3, 4, 5 year lease. But first and foremost, I think anybody leasing a property's got to be respectful of the property. And really, it's residential tenancy is well prescribed and understand what your rights are.
All right, great to have you both in the studio sorting through this problem that is so real for so many of us. Malcolm, thank you so much for joining us.
Pleasure,
and Leah,
Tom.
Thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Some of these guys are getting paid up to $20,000 a night. Rhino horn is just another commodity.
Triple J. You are listening to Hack. I'm Tom Tilley. How far would you go to save a rhino or an elephant from poachers? Last year on Hack, we spoke to a guy, you just heard his voice there, who goes as far as killing poachers, actually killing human beings to stop them killing rhinos and elephants. Here's part of that story we did with Damien Mander.
The only thing that's going to stop that animal from being killed is a good person with a gun standing between the animal and the poacher. And that's just the reality of the situation that we have.
Damien Mander served in Iraq. He's been a sniper and cleared underwater bombs for the Navy. He went to Africa to find his next adventure.
Realised pretty quickly that there's more to life than scratching your own itch and running around looking for the next adventure. So I'll put my money where my mouth is and set up the International Anti-Poaching Foundation.
Damien's group is trying to do their bit to disrupt the illegal wildlife trade that Interpol reckons is worth between $10 and $20 billion a year. He's working with local rangers to track down poachers.
When these guys are motivated, they're going to get up and they're going to walk 20 to 30 k's a day. And when they're walking the 20 to 30 k's a day, they're going to find footprints in the dirt. They then follow that, they find the poachers and they stop animals from being killed.
Poaching is a big deal in Africa. Up to 35,000 elephants are killed annually, and the black rhino population has fallen by 97% since 1960. That's according to the African Wildlife Foundation. In South Africa alone, more than 1,300 rhinos were poached in 2015. That's more than 25 each week.
We deal with a very specific side of poaching, and that is protecting animals like elephant and rhino. They're the hardest animals to protect.
Damien told us the people he's fighting against are pretty full-on. There's big money in poaching. Rhino horn is worth more than its weight in gold on the black market.
You've got to get out of your mind this poor African living in a mud hut who's just trying to put food on the table. This is organised crime and guerrilla warfare. Some of these guys are getting paid up to $20,000 a night. So this is the same syndicates that are involved with human trafficking, child prostitution, drugs, guns. Rhino horn is just another commodity.
Hack on Triple J with Tom Tilley.
It's a hectic industry. It's a big problem. And for Damien, poaching the poachers is part of the solution. It's a very violent solution. There's another solution on the table, less violent, 3D printing rhino horns and then flooding the black market with them. It sounds crazy. Maybe it's so crazy it could just work. There's a Seattle-based startup developing prototypes right now. They're called Pembian, and Matthew Marcus is the founder. Matthew, thank you for joining us on Hack.
Thank you for having me, Tom.
What's made you so passionate about saving rhinos? Was it something you saw, something you heard?
My passion for saving rhinos, I guess, has evolved over time. It started as sort of an interesting question about what would happen if you could create sort of wildlife products de novo back many, many, many years ago now. And it evolved over time as technology evolved to becoming something that I actually wanted to see established in practice.
And how bad has the rhino poaching problem become?
So there was a period of time in the 90s when it kind of abated. Prior to that, it was very, very bad. And then in the mid-2000s, it picked up again, going from a few hundred rhinos being killed to about 1,000 per year being killed now.
Okay, so tell us about your solution of 3D printing rhino horns. I want to find out how you make them in just a moment. But first, how would creating fake rhino horns reduce poaching?
So there's two ways you might want to intervene in the market from a supply side standpoint. That is creating the product that people desire. One is to farm the animals, which for a variety of economic ethical reasons probably shouldn't be done. Alternatively, if you biofabricate rhino horn and you biofabricate it at a price much lower than you can farm it at, then you set up a different sort of equation, which is basically that biofabricated horn then should start migrating into the illegal market. So instead of moving people from the illegal market to the legal market, what you have is product move en masse at a lower price point from the biofabricated market into the legal market and thereby sort of flood it.
So basically you want to dupe the people in this market into thinking your product is real so that then people get confused about what's real and then the value goes out of the market, the price drops.
Yeah, and it's not necessarily directly us. It's something that you would call an arbitrage opportunity for others. So basically, if you would imagine that you could go down to the store and get a biofabricated horn for, let's say, $5, that's just as an example, and somebody on the illicit market wanted it for $10, then you go down to the store and buy as many as you could and then resell them. But over time, the people on the illicit market would be like, hold on, he's just getting this from the store and selling to us. But we can't really determine that for sure, but we know we shouldn't be paying more than $5. And if you do that over time, you can use technology and drop the price to a certain level. You can drop the price low enough whereby nobody's ever going to basically get it illicitly, like from the wild.
So basically, the whole theory depends on your horns being so good that experts in this industry, people that have been working in it for years, won't know the difference.
Yes, yes.
So how would you get these fake horns into the market? Would you be going to Africa and trying to convince these people that are collecting them and the poachers and the people they trade with to start selling these to their trusted customers? I mean, how would you get them to do that?
We'd actually start higher up the supply chain, closer to Asia. I mean, I've been to Vietnam. I've talked to people who work in the industry because, again, there's a legal industry of carving and an illegal industry of wildlife carving, let's say. And so these two industries kind of float next to each other. I mean, if you have a carving factory and maybe your morals aren't as great as somebody else's who has a carving factory, you might choose sometimes to carve illicit products because they're more profitable. And so you have this kind of situation where there's a legal trade and an illegal trade kind of like working side by side. But we've talked to people and some of these people are legitimate and some of these people are illegitimate. But there's been a kind of a response of people wanting to buy this product because, again, for the legitimate people, they're going to resell it as biofabricated. For the illegitimate people, they'll relabel it and probably sell it as wild. But they're looking that they're going to get a bigger profit by doing this, by fooling the customer, so to speak.
Matthew, let's talk about the technological side of what you're doing. How are you going about developing a fake rhino horn so good you can dupe these sellers and buyers?
Yeah, dupe everybody. That's a good question. That's a technical challenge. What we did early on was to create powders, was to sort of find and isolate genetic sequences that code for the keratins and other proteins found in rhino horn. When we realized that the powder wasn't probably going to be sufficient for what we wanted to do from a sort of social impact perspective, we moved on to sort of trying to figure out a way of creating that powder into a solid. That was our 3D printing technique. That has worked relatively well. We are able to produce small solids. The solids are pretty good, but they're probably not good enough, again, to fool these experts, like you said, or people who've worked in this trade for a long period of time. We're looking at also things that are going on in medicine as far as stem cells are concerned and growing organs and tissues and how that may be applicable to this problem.
Great to speak to you. Thanks for joining us on the show.
Thank you, Tom. Thank you for having me.
Hack on Triple J.
Matthew Marcus, who's running a Seattle-based startup called Pembian, and they're working on prototypes trying to use 3D printing to make really realistic but fake rhino horns and then flood the market and confuse the people buying them on the text line. These guys are heroes. Flood the market. Another person raising a very pertinent question. Will it make genuine ivory more desirable and expensive? Someone else commenting on Damian Mander, who we heard before. He poaches the poachers. I saw this guy talk last year. He's doing a great job, but it's a hard battle to win. Now, a third person who has another very different approach to trying to stop the poaching going ahead is Gail Burgess. She's in Vietnam, where there's a huge demand for rhino horn and ivory. She works with TRAFFIC, the Wildlife Trade Monitoring Network. Now, Gail, thank you so much for joining us there in Vietnam. We'll find out what you're doing in just a moment. But what do you think of the 3D printing idea?
Thanks, Tom. Nice to speak with everybody this afternoon. So, I think a general reaction, there's a risk that consumer acceptance could be nil or much lower than expected. I think whether substitutes are acceptable, consumers depends on a combination of factors. Mm. Two of those are how close the substitute is to the real thing, and secondly, how consumers perceive this based on complex combination of their sort of values, attitudes and beliefs. The market for rhino horn is very sensitized to fakes and imitations already. So our focus has instead been on using behavioral change techniques to reduce demand.
Yeah, it's interesting. I imagine lots of people have tried to sell fake rhino horns because they're worth so much money. And I wonder, do you feel it's a bit naive for this company to feel like they could be the ones that would dupe the market?
It really depends on sort of the, you know, how the product looks and why consumers are demanding this in the first place. One of the things that we've found in this work in Vietnam is that, people are keen to acquire the real thing because of its rarity and how exclusive it is. And, you know, their aim is to demonstrate status and success. This is the main sort of driver for this in Vietnam, and something that we've been able to design some behavioral change messaging around. We use a Chi initiative I can explain in a minute.
Okay, and are there also people using it for medicinal purposes?
That is also a use type. Yeah, we sort of in our approach we describe things as either sort of emotional or functional use. The major use type in Vietnam that we found is for this emotional use. So the rhino horn's sort of used as a symbol of wealth and power, and it's strongly associated with success and demonstrating kind of social standing. I think this is how we've kind of focused our messaging based on some research we did in 2013.
Okay, so the work you're doing in Vietnam is to try and change the culture, stopping people from actually desiring rhino horns and ivory. How are you going about doing that?
Well, it's focused on rhino horn. It's not kind of trying to change the culture. It's actually using a concept that's already well established within Vietnamese culture, and so we'll be led by Vietnamese champions for this. It's called Chi. We were keen to kind of avoid overt association with conservation kind of messaging in a way, because the research showed that it wouldn't necessarily be the most powerful way to get people to change. So Chi is a kind of a concept about your inner strength, and the basic message that we're using is that success and status can come from your Chi and not from a piece of rhino horn. And we've been setting up some great partnerships with groups like the Vietnamese Chamber of Commerce and Industry, who have good outreach to, who we think the target audience are for this work. And they're kind of embedding this message within corporate social responsibility practices across all of their membership. And we've got champions from within that group kind of ready to stand up and say, you know, they're proud of their business success because of the sort of diligence they've showed on a personal level, that they've drawn their success from their Chi, not from a piece of horn.
Wow, I guess there's lots of ways people can feel good about themselves and reflect their status. I'm interested to know why Chi would necessarily replace rhino horn, or why they wouldn't want both. But we are about to hit the clock. It's fascinating to hear about all the different ways people are trying to stop rhino poaching. Thank you so much for joining us, Gail.
Great stuff. Thanks very much, Tom.
Hack
on Triple J.